We have Brother Joshua Tubbs with us this morning. He is a second-year student at Southeast Institute of Biblical Studies in Knoxville, Tennessee. Many of us remember it at East Tennessee School of Preachings and Missions, still the same place. We've had a long relationship with that school there and have supported young men there for about the last 15 years. One thing I find interesting and encouraging is that all the men, almost without exception, that we have supported there are men who have graduated from high school. Some of them have gone to college and gotten degrees. Some have worked, and then they decide that they're going to leave that and go back to go to preaching school to either preach full-time or preach part-time, prepare themselves for that. So it's young men who've made a tremendous commitment to leave a secular job, typically, to go back there. We also support the school directly. We support a student, and it's a two-year program. They graduate with a bachelor's degree, and we also support the school itself financially. Some background on Joshua. He's born in Milledgeville, Georgia, and his family now lives in Jasper, Alabama, but they lived for a while in Missouri and then in Bowling Green area of Kentucky, and he actually graduated from high school in Bowling Green. Prior to entering the school of preaching, he graduated from Western Kentucky University with a degree in agricultural education, that's in Bowling Green, and then completed all his coursework towards a master's degree at UK. And Joshua, I guess, was 5 years in Union, Kentucky at Larry Ryle High School. He was an agriculture teacher there and worshiped at the Grand County Church of Christ, which is a new church plant in that county from Lehman Avenue Church in Bowling Green. And Jerry Carmichael was the minister who many of us know. He was worshiping there. We made this decision to go, and Jerry Carmichael was influential in that, encouraging him to go. And actually, we were looking for someone to support at that time, and I saw Jerry in Owensville in a meeting and had a list of young men, and Josh was on the list, and he recommended that we financially support him, which we have done. Joshua was married in May of this year to Emily Blevins from Roanoke, Virginia. When he graduates in June, they plan to return to Jasper, which is also the hometown of Brad Moore's. There he plans to work with his father and brothers. They own a farm, 200-some-acre farm, and also a family business. And the business is animal research. Primarily, it's been pig research for various producers and companies, and also they operate that farm now. I think they're getting into some animal or cattle research as well. He intends to work in that business as well, to work with congregations in that area of the state of Alabama. When I first got information on Josh, when last night's the first time I met him, but I've corresponded a lot over the last year and a half, but on his application he made this statement, and he's fulfilling that objective he had. He says, "When finishing my biblical studies, I plan to return to the area near my family to help grow the Lord's church. With my work experience, I can carry on a secular job and work for the church if that is required of me. I feel I have a skill set that can be used in the Lord's work anywhere and hope to work in short missions as well. The Lord has truly blessed me with opportunities to grow in my life, and I know that I should use that opportunity to give back to Him and the communities that have influenced me in this life." So we're pleased to have Joshua with him and commend him for this commitment he has made. Now, Brother Joshua Tubbs.
If you have a Bible with you, and you should, turn to Matthew chapter 25, and we'll be there in a moment, verse 31, and we know this parable well, and many of us have read this and studied this section of Scripture before, and it's a topic that I like. I have a PowerPoint here, but I don't want to keep up with it, so I'm not going to put it up there. I think it's a little more... The PowerPoint's a little more class-oriented, and it may distract from the time here, but give you a little more. I appreciate the elders supporting me, and I appreciate them allowing me to be here. We've tried two other times for me to come, back in March and then back in July, both times, one time was a college advisor, and then this summer my grandmother passed away, and so both times were because of funerals. And I don't reckon I need to apologize for that, but you do need to be aware that those were the issues I was dealing with. And it's been a fun year, but then you have those struggles that are always in life. And so your support and your prayers and your help along the way has been encouraging. I talk to Mark pretty regular on the phone for somebody I'd never met before over the last year and a half. He called me on my birthday the past 2 years. He's called me at Christmas time, get a text message on my wedding day from him. So he's turned into kind of a really good friend for me, and I appreciate his family's time yesterday as they fixed a meal for me last night and this morning. And the one thing that I have learned since July of last year is that a preacher will not starve to death. I mean, I've seen it, but I didn't know it until I started getting involved with it more heavily. As he said, my plan is to work with my family. I have personal reasons for that, if you have the ability to support yourself and you have a career that you like or opportunities that you like, you can be beneficial to the church in that way, and teaching and preaching and being able to support yourself, especially congregations. Something I've noticed is a lot of congregations are smaller, and you know, they don't necessarily need to close their doors just because they're smaller. If they have a good core group of people there, they're going to grow and they're going to survive. And they need preachers and they need people, but they can't pay somebody a full-time salary. And so that's kind of what I saw when I was in Northern Kentucky. And you'll hear a little bit about Northern Kentucky from me. And that's where I spent the last 5 years with Jerry Carmichael at the Grant County Church. And that's where my growth as a Christian and my want to be a preacher developed from. So that's kind of a little bit more background on me. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "Life's most urgent question is, what are you doing for others?" When you look at Kids Against Hunger, which is a program that provides meals to children both in the U.S. and abroad, some statistics on starvation that are pretty alarming. Every 6 seconds, a child dies of hunger and hunger-related causes. 10.9 million children under the age of 5 die each year in developing countries. 60% of this is due to hunger and malnutrition. 60% of hungry people are women, and 684,000 children's deaths worldwide can be prevented by increasing access to vitamin A and zinc. A vitamin and a mineral could save 600,000 lives. When we think about the idea of service and service to others, the ultimate example of that is Jesus Christ. Jesus reached more souls in his ministry because he took care of their needs physically before he took care of their needs spiritually. And we have examples of that throughout the New Testament. He healed a blind man, John chapter 9. He fed 5,000 in John chapter 6. He healed the leprosy from 10 different men, of which one of them returned to thank him. And though we don't see a case of conversion in every one of those examples, he took care of their needs. When was the last time we made a practice of serving others? When was the last time we woke up and said, "I'm going to help somebody today? No matter what their need, no matter what they do, I'm going to help them." A modern definition of the idea of service is contributing to somebody's welfare. When was the last time we got up in the morning and said, "I'm going to make somebody's day better that really needs it"? At the same time, I use the example of Jesus, and we don't have the capability of the miracles that he used, but what are some things that we can do? What are some practices that we can put into our lives daily that's going to make a difference to somebody and could potentially lead them to Christ? As we go through our lesson today, we're going to look at what we're doing to help other people. What are you doing to help others? Who is serving about? What's our purpose? Who's the driving force behind that? And who are we responsible to help? In James chapter 2. Beginning in verse 14. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. When we define service to others, I tend to think about this verse right here. What we do for others. And we might think our responsibility is to teach them to be a Christian. And yes, that is part of our responsibility. But look what he says in verse 15 and 16. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking daily food, and one says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for their body, what good is that? I can teach somebody about Jesus, and they can sit there the entire time thinking, I wish I had a hamburger. I wish I had a handful of potato chips or just something in my belly right now. I wish I had a jacket on right now. It's cold outside, but I don't own a jacket. And he's standing here stopping me on the street corner. Have you ever thought about that? The way we approach people, the way that we think to help people, we think, oh, well, I'm just going to go in and I'm going to start telling them about Jesus. Well, Jesus didn't even start at that point. He started with, what do you need? Physically, what do you need to be comfortable? To feel like you are where you should be physically and health? And in comfort, and then I'll talk to you. When he was teaching the 5,000 in John chapter 6, and he taught all day, his realization was they need food, they need sustenance. And so they sought out a way to feed the 5,000. What did he do after he fed them? He continued to teach them. We ever really stopped to think about the implication of his actions in that situation? When we look at Matthew chapter 25 and we begin in verse 34, and I asked you to flip there when I started. When you go to chapter 25, verse 34, we're going to go through this parable and add some coinciding verses to think about as we look at this parable. In this parable, we're talking about the judgment. And he's put the sheep to the right and the goats to the left, and he's talking to them. And when we start in verse 34, it says, then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. The sheep, in verses 35 and 36, provided. They provided for him when he was hungry, when he was thirsty, when they didn't know who he was, when he was naked, and when he was sick. They were called righteous because they did something for somebody. Not because they taught them anything, not because they shared the good news, but because they did something for someone. It's a first step. The first step to being Christ-like is doing stuff for people, providing for other people, contributing to other people's welfare. That's the first step. And if we can't get that down, then we're going to be in the group of the goats. They did not even remember doing this stuff for the Lord. He said, you did this for me. And they said, Lord, when did we do this for you? What was his statement? As you did for the least of these, my brothers, you did it for me. We'll come back to that statement in our next point, but to continue with this, the idea in verses 35 and 36 and following through that story with the sheep, we have what is the fulfillment of the greatest two commands. We remember Matthew chapter 22, verse 37, just a couple pages back in your Bible. And as you read that, they come up to him in verse 36, "Teacher, which is the great command in the law?" And he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first command. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." These two commandments, all the law and the prophets. These commandments are not new. John chapter 13, he says, "A new commandment I give unto you, love one another." And then we look here, he said it in Matthew 22, before that time. As we go back into the Old Testament, we see both of these things are said in the Torah. Deuteronomy 6:5, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength." Leviticus 19:18, "Love your neighbor as yourself." They're not new. In fact, they're the very first laws, or part of the very first laws that were given to the Jewish nation. Folks, the very basis of righteousness is loving other people. Doing for other people what you do for yourself. The goats, on the other hand, give us an example of what service is not. What is not contributing to other people's welfare. And we read verses 41 through 45, and we see the opposite of what happened in the previous three or four verses there. "Then he will say to those on his left, 'Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me.' Then they also answer, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you?' And he will answer them, saying, 'Truly I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me.' And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life." You see, the goats had a problem. And their problem was they loved themselves and nobody else. They took care of themselves and nobody else. They provided for themselves, but they did not concern themselves with the welfare of others. As a Christian, looking at this parable, and as we go through this throughout the epistles, we see that the very basis of Christianity is taking care of others' needs, first physically and then spiritually. And that cannot be forgotten. How can you expect someone to sit down and listen to you about Jesus Christ when they haven't eaten in 3 days and they don't know where their next meal comes from? You can't. And anybody that's taught school or taught a class, you can see when people are lacking in part of their life. Sometimes they're lacking sleep, and it's not us to call on things like that. They need to sleep. That's the way we're built. And we need to eat, and we need to be warm and comfortable in the wintertime, and we need to be cool and not as hot in the summertime. And when we're not comfortable, we're not willing to listen. And that, I know that we live in a society where things are readily available, but it doesn't take away from our responsibility to make sure people have those things. And we're not talking about luxury cars and boats and big fancy houses. We're talking about food and clothing. The very necessities of life lie in food, fiber, and shelter. And if we don't have those three things, we're not really concerned about anything else. We're worried about surviving. So who is service really about, though? When we look at these verses, he points out, "As you did to the least of these." and that you're to love your neighbor as yourself. Who is service about? In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 5 through 8, Paul writes to them, and in this case he's referring to slaves and their attitude toward their master. But there's some application to us as Christians today. We don't understand the concept of slavery quite like they had it then. Our perception is very focused into the situations that existed in our country. But slavery back then was a little bit different. And it changed depending on who was the master. But here's some points that he makes. Verse 5 through 8, slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. Not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will, as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. What does that mean for us? He makes this same statement in Colossians chapter 3. He warns us not to be men pleasers, but to do the will of God. Part of the will of God, from what we read in James and Matthew, is to do good unto others, specifically to take care of their physical needs. He explains that good works to men should be done as to the Lord. When we work, and I know a lot of us know Colossians 3, 23 and 24, work heartily as unto the Lord. Everything we do is a reflection of an attitude. Our attitude towards that task. Our attitude towards our work. He reiterates that again in 3:24 of Colossians. He reiterates the point that he makes in verse 8 of Ephesians 6. And that what we do will be returned to us as an inheritance. What Jesus points out in Matthew 25, in verse 40 and verse 45, is that our attitude toward other people reflects our attitude of God. When I look at another man and I look down my nose at him because he's standing on a street corner with a sign, that reflects my attitude towards God. We have to start looking at people as souls. And when we start looking at people as souls, souls that need to be in heaven with us in eternity, it will change our attitude toward those in need. It will change our attitude in the way we approach our worship. It'll change our attitude in the way we approach our jobs and our day-to-day task. There are things that I hate to do. There are certain things around the house. Folding laundry. I would rather have my fingernails plucked off than fold laundry. And I'm sure there are other people in the room that feel the same way. But if my wife asked me to fold some of the laundry, I'm going to do it. I may not do it with a smile on my face, even though I should. But I'm going to do it. Why? Because it reflects my respect of her when I do what she asked me to, when it's something that I have the capability to do. Now, she may disagree. I may not do it the way she wants to. I don't know. I hope I do. But she has never yelled at me for folding laundry, and I don't think I've ever yelled at her for folding laundry. When we do our task, when we do our day-to-day task, you ever thought about that reflects our attitude towards God? That's a scary thought when we think about some of the attitudes that we take to work. When we take it into our home and when we bring it in the church building. That's a very scary thought because we know, and I'm as guilty as anybody in the room, we all know we're guilty of that. Just having the wrong attitude towards other people. And it's not necessarily, you don't have to talk about people who are in need. We can talk about the things that we do at home and the things we do at church and the things we do at work. And not ever talk about helping others. Our attitude reflects our thoughts of God. and the way that I treat my spouse, the way that I treat children, the way that I treat my coworkers. It's a reflection of my attitude towards God. And when I understand in Genesis 1:27 that I'm made in His image and you're made in His image and the guy on the street sleeping in the cardboard box is made in God's image, it changes my attitude and my approach to how I help others. It doesn't mean I necessarily sell all of my possessions and live in a cardboard box too. But the point is that as we do to the least of these, we do also to Christ. And we need to think about that when we're acting. We need to think about that when our attitude isn't where it's supposed to be at. Service is not about me loving me or me loving my neighbor as myself, but it's about Deuteronomy 6:5 and loving the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. Because in that commandment is the law and the prophets. Because it is the all in all. That's going to change my approach to everything I do. With that in mind, who are we to be of service to? The New Testament is full of situations where we are to be of service to our fellow Christians, to our fellow man, and to people that we come in contact to day in and day out. Let's look at a few of these. The first one, Titus 3:14 and Luke 3:11, both make the same point. Luke 3:11, John the Baptist is asked, what should we do? In 3:10. 3:11, he replies, those of you with two tunics, give to him who has none, and he with food do likewise. Back to the food and clothing again. It's a pattern. It's a principle. It's well established. People in urgent needs need to be taken care of. How do we identify urgent needs? You know, that's a whole nother lesson, a Sunday school that we could sit down and talk about, maybe a discussion that we could have at some time. How do we identify urgent needs? Well, the first place I would look is Luke 3:11, and then I could build from there. Somebody comes to me and says, I don't have the money to pay a light bill, and I have the ability to pay a light bill. Guy needs $10 worth of gas, and I've got $10 in my wallet. It's time to start thinking about our decisions like that as well. A quick story. This happened in the summer of 2012. We were doing a door-knocking campaign for VBS. A group from Tennessee, from West Tennessee, had driven 10 hours to come up and host our VBS. And they do this every year at Grant County, or they did for 3 years that I was there. And they did it this past summer. And they go around and they knock doors and invite people to VBS. And I come in from work that Monday afternoon and sit down with a meal with the door knockers that day. And the leader of the group, the youth minister from this church, Jeff, comes up to me and says, Josh, do you know where I can get a refrigerator? I had just bought a new refrigerator and put it in my kitchen, and my old one was in my basement. I said, come and get it. He said, are you sure? I said, yeah, come and get it. He said, can we use your truck tomorrow? I said, yeah, I'm not working tomorrow. We'll just do that tomorrow. So we load this refrigerator on my truck. We drive it into this neighborhood. There was a woman and a man that lived there. I believe they were married with three children. And the refrigerator had gone out. They had lost all the food that was in the refrigerator. While we were there installing the refrigerator, the landlord comes with an eviction notice. They were 3 months behind on rent. Mind you, there's three children, 11 and under. We installed the refrigerator. We go back to the hotel. Jeff comes to me, there was an adult man there from their congregation as well named John. And he said, should we go pay the back rent for him? My thought was, and I said this to him, and I'm ashamed that I said this to him, I said, you're creating a case of dependency if you do it. I wouldn't. Those were my words to him. And Jeff looked at me in the eye and said, there's children there. He said, I think I have to. And he's right. If I had the ability to do that, I'm obligated to do that. So Jeff and John go and pay the back rent while me and two of the ladies go to the grocery store and put food in their refrigerator. So at the end of the day, we'd give them a refrigerator, food, and they at least have 1 month that they can stay in that house that they were in. My attitude was wrong. The end result was the right one, I believe. But it made a difference in my life and the way that I approach things when Jeff gave me that example to follow. And it's one that I won't ever forget. Some thoughts for you along these lines of urgent needs. When I was writing this lesson and preparing and studying, there's a food bank in East Tennessee called Second Harvest. It covers an 18-county area. And I imagine these statistics are probably reflective all throughout Appalachia. 1 in 6 residents in East Tennessee live in poverty. 1 in 5 children is at risk of going hungry in East Tennessee. That's 20% of children in the area that I live in that do not know where their next meal will come from. They leave school Friday afternoon, and they may not eat again until Monday morning. And anybody that's taught in any school at any level, volunteered or whatever, has seen that. And the very basis of our religion, according to James 2, 14 through 17, is to take care of those needs. When was the last time that we did something like that for our neighbors? When was the last time we reached out to somebody in the church that needed that? When was the last time we just asked somebody, hey, do you need anything? I see you've got 2 or 3 kids and your husband works, 8 hours a day, and maybe I can come over tomorrow and help you for a little bit. That's the very basis of what we've been called to do. The next group of people, James 1:27, pure and undefiled religion is what? Helping the orphans and widows in their time of need. Pure and undefiled religion is helping orphans and widows in their time of need. When was the last time we just went to an elderly person's house that lived alone and let them tell their stories? Anybody who has grandparents knows that you're going to hear the same stories over and over again. In fact, I'll be at my grandfather's house next weekend, and he'll probably tell me the same stories he told me in July, and the same stories he told me in June, and the same stories he told me in May. And I'm going to sit and listen to him, because that's what he wants to do. And that's what he remembers. And he may not remember anything else about me, but he'll remember that I sat and listened to him. It makes a difference. Can we not serve as role models to young people? Can we not go play a game of pickup basketball? Pure and undefiled religion. The next group of people we're responsible for is our families. 1 Timothy 5:8. What does he call the man that doesn't take care of his family? He's worse than an unbeliever. We're responsible to our families. And then Galatians 6:10, do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. So 2 more groups, all men and the household of faith. We've got a responsibility to our church family to take care of their needs, their day-to-day, their hunger, their thirst, their nakedness, their sickness. We have a responsibility to our neighbor, all men. So as we come to a close, I want to give you another set of statistics. I like statistics because I think they prove some things. In this case, if we were to take the world population and take the same demographics of the world population and put it into a village of 100 people, there would be 33 Christians. There would be half of the wealth owned by 6 people, all from the United States. 7 people would have college degrees, and 7 people would be unable to read and write. This is people over the age of 15. 13 would be malnourished, and 25 would live in substandard housing. The point is, to live where we live and to have what we have, we are very blessed. We are blessed, and we have the ability to help others. Amen. So the questions come to you now. James 1:27, is your religion pure and undefiled, or is your faith dead? James 2:17. The actions, the works of a Christian are good deeds to others. As we treat others, it reflects our attitude towards God. And people are paying attention when they know we're Christians. So our question is, what are we doing for others? If you haven't been what you need to be as a Christian and helping others, we have a whole congregation here today, and we have a whole network of Christians and churches throughout this country. Everywhere we go, we have the opportunity to help. Sometimes it's just a kind word. Sometimes it's a little bit of money. Sometimes it's needs that we don't always see. But we have an obligation to find out and take care of those needs. If you have a need today, we have an obligation to help you. If you have the need to become a Christian, you have the opportunity to do that today. Confessing your belief in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, understanding that through Him and only through Him, by faith, through grace, and through the forgiveness of sin and baptism, you can be a part of His family. If you need any of those things, please come forward as we stand and sing.
Rock of ages, clap for me. Let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from thy riven side which flow be of sin the double cure. Cleanse me from its guilt and fountain fly.